You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on SiriusXM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio at every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. More people watching or listening to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Hot lanes. We're going to get into this in just a second. Grover Cleveland. This is a fascinating piece in the New York Times about a little history of Grover Cleveland and Clara Barton that I didn't know about. I want to share with you. Do taxes drive people to move out of state? Interesting study out of California. Peter Ferrara with the Carlson Center is going to be with us in the second hour. We're going to be talking about the feudal lords are back in Pennsylvania. Governor Tom Corbett is about to sign a bill, probably after the election, that says that your employer can keep your state income taxes. They don't even tell you. They just take the money. Yeah. So Peter thinks it's a great idea. I think it's insane. But, you know, let's start out with this whole thing about these hot lanes, high-occupancy vehicles. They've turned into high-occupancy toll lanes, which is a fancy way of saying, you pay more to use the lane where you don't have to go slow with the riffraff, the high-speed lane. You just pay a little extra. Lexus lanes. What a fine idea. Randall O'Toole, a senior fellow with the Cato Institute, author of several books, including The Vanishing Automobile and Other Urban Myths, Cato.org, of course, the website, on the line with us. Hey, Randall.
Hi.
So why should any state, now this, first of all, the nine states have put this into place, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Minnesota, Texas, Utah, and Washington. They let rich people drive faster for a price. This makes no sense to me. It's like saying, if you pay a little more for the if you tip the fire department, they'll come faster. I mean, don't we have this thing called the commons where at least at the level of the stuff that we all collectively own, like our roads, we're all treated equally?
Well, you know, the tragedy of the commons is that they get overused. And when you have a commons, and in terms of a highway, it gets heavily congested and you get stuck in traffic.
Well, if you're going to quote Garrett Hardin, you should.
People will use the hot lanes. But in fact, studies show that everybody needs to get to work on time sometimes. For example, in California, there's a hot lane. It costs $9 to use it. And they interviewed people who were not rich. And they said, hey, my babysitter charges me $5 per child per minute if I'm late. So it's worth it for me to pay $9 to avoid being a couple minutes late.
Yeah, the old babysitter story, I know, is the one that you guys are pushing. And if you're going to quote Garrett Hardin on the tragedy of the commons, you should read the piece, because, you know, this would defy that. In fact, what Garrett Hardin, when he wrote that back in the 60s, his point was that this is the tragedy of the commons. It's not overgrazing. It's the abuse of the commons by very wealthy people. That's the tragedy of the commons, is somebody coming in and saying, oh yeah, we're gonna separate out our own little piece of this and exploit it to the benefit of everybody else. You may have an occasional person who's trying to get home to pay the babysitter, but the vast majority of people who are, you know, there's a lot of, as you well know, Randall, there are a lot of people in this country for whom spending an extra $1,000 a month or a year, as the case may be, to be able to travel in luxury in their Lexus and not have to hang out with the riffraff is frankly no big deal. Why should I be paying for the cost in terms of everything from eminent domain, taking that land in the first place, to the building of the highway, the construction of the highway, which we're all paying for, to the protection of the highway, the police, the fire, the emergency services? Why should all of us be paying for that so that we can have a special lane that rich people pay a little extra for and they can drive 60 or 70 miles an hour instead of 20 or 30 or 40?
Well, I actually think that all lanes should be tolled, because tolls will allow the highway owners to make sure the roads never get congested. And I think it's worth it for everybody to not have to deal with congested traffic. But there is a lot of resistance to tolling all the lanes. So right now, the The idea is if we build new lanes, let's toll the new lanes and have those lanes be uncongested so that people have a choice.
Right. So you see this.
Life is about choices. When you go to a grocery store, you can buy hamburger or filet mignon. When you go get some clothes,
the grocery store is not part of the commons.
Made suit,
a clothing store is not part of the commons.
And the choices people make are based on their own particular concerns.
Grocery stores and clothing stores are not part of the commons. They are not essential to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the reason for which this country was established. The reason why we created this country was to define and protect the commons. And I get it, the libertarians like you believe that there should be no transportation commons. I'm assuming that you also don't think that we should have rail systems that are our railroads should be owned by the government, Amtrak, that privatize the whole thing, right?
Well, you say you've read Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons. I knew yes. Garrett Hardin, and I don't think he was saying what you're saying he said.
Okay.
The tragedy of the commons is that if you have a commons, it's going to be overused.
Well, the example he was using was the original Boston
commons. You want to take things that don't have to be a commons and make them into a commons as if it's somehow a good thing that we have a lot of things that are going to be overused and harmed through that overuse.
No, for the record, the tragedy of the commons, filibustering me is no way to win an argument, Randall. It really isn't. And his whole point in the tragedy of the commons, and which has been made many, many times, is that if the commons is free to all, then those, and he was talking about the Boston Commons and people bringing their sheep or their cows in there, that eventually somebody's going to come along with a giant herd and say, okay, I'll use this, and basically bump everybody else out. Right?
No, eventually everybody together will overuse it. If you have 20 people or 200 people or 2,000 people who have access to it, they'll each use it a little bit too much.
Well, his piece was in defense of the commons. You're arguing that there should be no commons.
Freeways, we don't have some rich person coming in and running 10,000 cars. We have each person in their own individual cars, and because it's the commons, the highways are overused. And they're heavily congested. It costs people billions of dollars a year. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars of wasted fuel a year. It leads to all kinds of air pollution. Anything we can do to relieve congestion is a good thing. And the best way to relieve congestion
is by letting rich people have their own lanes.
Variable tolls.
No, I don't disagree with you, actually, that putting a toll on a road will discourage people from using it and thus reduce the use of it and encourage things like carpooling. But saying that, and in fact, this was the original HOV rationale, which I support. I think everybody pretty much supported, which was, if you have two people or three people or more in your car, then you can travel in this faster lane, and you don't have to pay anything for that. You have to be a part of the community. You have to agree to this social standard. You're saying, though, that to hell with the social standard, whoever's got the most money gets the best perks.
It's not a matter of who has the most money. It's
who's willing to spend the most money.
What is your priority? Do you have to get somewhere on time today? In which case, you'll decide to drive at a time that it might cost a little more. We're not talking about a fixed toll. We're talking about a variable toll.
No, we're talking about a special lane. We're not talking about the entire highway.
During the peak period of the day, and if we can just...
Randall, we're talking about a special lane, not the entire highway.
I think it works better with the entire highway, but let's talk about a special lane. If we have a special lane that allows free-flowing traffic all the time, experience shows that special lane takes a lot of traffic off of the untold lane.
So the rich using their own special lane will trickle down to us by reducing the consumption for all the rest of them. Okay, got it. Randall O'Toole, Senior Fellow of the Cato Institute, cato.org. Randall, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, do you really think that we should have special lanes for wealthy people? How about special fire departments for wealthy people? Well, now here's where this metaphor gets really interesting. If we're going to say, okay, let's take the commons of our roads and turn them over to, if we were to take the logical extension, where Randall O'Toole was taking this thing, where the Cato Institute advocates, and basically turn them over to Bain Capital. Turn them over to any company that wants to buy them. Privatize the roads. Let them put up toll booths and have corporations run the roads. That's, you know, a theft or an acquisition of the commons, arguably. And consider, you know, that's the sort of thing that would have to be done by government action. Because we live in a representative democratic republic, not a pure democracy. We don't actually, well, the exception of ballot initiatives, we don't vote on laws. We vote on legislators who make laws. But even when we vote, or even with ballot initiatives, when we vote on laws, at least we're directing the process, or we're directing the process through the people we elect. So if privatizing roads, if taking that part of our commons and taking it private is arguably a bad thing, and I would say it is, but you know, we can debate it. If there should be a legitimate debate about it and we, the people, should decide, then isn't the most egregious sin against democracy in the commons privatizing the vote? I mean, consider that for a moment. How do we decide whether or not we're going to privatize our roads? We do so by either, you know, ballot measure or by electing people who would do that. But how do you know when your vote's been privatized and the private voting company, machine companies, will not tell you how you voted, will not tell you, you know, what they know? This is the I think the biggest picture here is this question of privatization of everything. Of course, you know, the conservatives want to privatize everything. There's the top 1% would just, you know, hey, love to live in a country. At least they think they would. Love to live in a country where, hey, you know, we can travel on the fast lanes. We get, you know, nice neighborhoods. Quack, quack, quack. The problem is, if you've ever lived or worked in, and I've done both, countries where the rich really do have all those privileges and everybody else is poor. I mean, I remember walking out of a hotel in Bombay, India, back in 1980, the first time I went to that country, and just being besieged by little kids with their hands out, beggars, you know, with sores all over them and flies and lepers literally on the street corner. There are some very wealthy people in India. And they live in gated communities, and they've got their own separate fire and police departments, and, you know, it's a libertarian paradise, or at least it was in the 80s. It's actually getting more that way these days. But to the point of the commons, if we're going to privatize the commons, do we really want to privatize the vote as well? The arguments that are made by libertarians and Republicans on these issues are, you know, well, private corporations can do things more efficiently. The fact of the matter is that Medicaid, which is our health insurance for the poor, for elderly, it covers about 50 million Americans. Working people who don't make a lot of money, don't make more than $30,000-$40,000 a year. Medicaid is 20% more efficient. It operates at a 20% lower overhead cost than for-profit health insurance. So you privatize it, what do? You create another Stephen Jay Hemsley or another Bill McGuire. You create another billionaire. These are the billionaire CEOs of United Health Insurance, United Healthcare. You create more billionaires. Over 100 people, you know, make over $1 million a year at United Healthcare. You create more millionaires. Do you do anything for the nation? Do you do anything for the commons? No, nothing. Or you're providing the same service, but at a higher price. This is why we segregate these things that are the commons from the things that aren't. This is why it's insane that we ever privatized our voting machines. Now you can say, well, you know, hey, technology marches on. We used to have these lever machines. I remember as a little kid, you know, my mom was one of those people who signed people in to vote down at the local elementary school. And I remember hanging out with her and watching her sign people in, and then they'd go and they'd pull the curtain in the voting machine, and it was a lever machine, and they'd pull the lever, and you could you could walk around the back of the machine. I did it. And you could see all the little gears turning, and you could see the counters counting. Everything was completely transparent. But more importantly, not only was everything completely transparent, you knew how the machine worked. The machines were owned by the government. Yes, they were made by private corporations. Nobody's objecting to that. I mean, walk into any government office, you're going to see computers that were made by private corporations. But they're owned by the government. Do you really think for a minute, even for a minute, that the CIA or the FBI or the U.S. Department of State or the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, whatever, would say, oh, yeah, sure, let's have a private corporation come in, install machines for us, install computers for us, and service them, and they run all the software, they maintain all the software, they decide what the programs are, they don't tell us what they are, so that when we're doing our war planning or when we're tracking down, you know, bad guys, we have no way of knowing if they're looking over our shoulder or they're messing with us. No, come on, that's crazy. So if you're going to have voting machines, at least have them be owned by the government, not leased from or rented basically from a for-profit corporation. Have them be maintained in a publicly accessible way. Just like our roads should be. If you want to cut down on congestion on the roads, provide people with a better alternative. Do better city planning like they do in Portland, Oregon. Come up with good light rail systems and mass transit systems like they do in big cities here in Washington, D.C. I've lived here 2 years. We sold our car when we left Portland. Never bought another one. I don't need one. So we really need to have a serious conversation in this country about the commons. It needs to become part of our political debate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And frankly, part of that discussion should be the commons of our voting systems, something that even the folks at Think Progress don't seem to want to talk about.
Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm going to be a star. Baby, you can drive my car.
Indeed. Well, you can't drive my car, but... And I don't have an HOT lane, these high HO high toll lanes, as opposed to high occupancy vehicle lanes, high occupancy toll lanes. I don't have a hot toll lane for you, but I do have a book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, the original book, and still the best book, I think, out there on corporate personhood, going all the way back to the founding of our country, starting at that point and coming all the way to Citizens United and past. And we're going to give away a copy of Unequal Protection, brought to you by Stamps.com, mailed to you by Stamps.com, via Stamps.com, when Shane decides that a caller has tickled his fancy, or some variation thereof. So, anyhow. Breaking news. Mayor Bloomberg of New York City, the mayor of New York City, has just endorsed for president, drum roll. You'll recall yesterday and the day before, yesterday and the day before, there was all that noise coming out of the Fox News and the right-wing machine about how Mayor Bloomberg did not want Barack Obama to come to New York City. Well, he wasn't going there anyway. He was going to New Jersey. New Jersey was where the really bad damage was. And having the president show up in New York City, New York City is such a gridlock to begin with. It wouldn't make any sense. But nonetheless, the speculation was that Bloomberg was dissing Obama. So Bloomberg came out today with an endorsement. He said, we can't do it alone. We need leadership from the White House. And over the past 4 years, President Obama has taken major steps to reduce our carbon consumption, including setting higher fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks. His administration has also adopted tighter controls on mercury emissions, which will help to close the dirtiest coal power plants, an effort I have supported through my philanthropy, which are estimated to kill 13,000 Americans a year, these power plants. And then he goes on to talk about Mitt Romney. Mayor Bloomberg says... Mitt Romney, too, has a history of tackling climate change. As governor of Massachusetts, he signed on to a regional cap and trade plan designed to reduce carbon emissions 10% below 1990 levels. Romney said at the time, the benefits of that plan will be long-lasting and enormous benefits to our health, our economy, our quality of life, our very landscape. Romney couldn't have been more right, the mayor says. But since then, he has reversed course, abandoning the very cap and trade program he once supported. This issue is too important. We need determined leadership at the national level to move the nation and the world forward. The mayor goes on to say that he believes that Mitt Romney understands that America was built on the premise of equal opportunity, not equal results. And he says, in the past, Romney has also taken sensible positions on immigration, illegal guns, abortion rights, and health care. But he has reversed course on all of them and is even running against the health care model he signed into law in Massachusetts. Therefore, Mayor Bloomberg says he is endorsing Mr. Obama. It's a fascinating study out of California. Jerry Brown is proposing in Proposition 30 to tax the rich a little bit, just a little bit, to help keep the state running. And, of course, there are rich people who are running ads going, oh, it's going to cause rich people to leave the state. They're going to go to Nevada. So they did a study on this. And this is done by sociologists at Stanford and Princeton University, and they looked into two tax changes in California. And what they found was that the highest income Californians were less likely to leave a state after a millionaire tax is passed. Now, why would rich people be more likely to stay in a state that raises taxes on rich people? Because it's using the money to create a better infrastructure. It's that story, you know, I started by telling you the story of, you know, walking out of the Taj Mahal Hotel in downtown Bombay back when it was called Bombay in India in 1980. Maybe it had just changed the name to Mumbai. And just, you know, Louise and I walking down the street with this entourage of little kids standing behind us begging with their hands out. Flash forward to year before last, Bloomberg News out of, you know, their interview guy out of Singapore interviewing a German businessman. And the American in Singapore says to the German businessman, what kind of taxes do you pay? You're a rich guy. What kind of taxes do you pay? The German businessman says, I think it's around 54-58%. And the guy looks horrified. He says, that's terrible. No, it's not a problem. And they change the topic and they go on. And then he comes back to the taxes again. And the guy says, I pay a lot of taxes. And then the third time he comes back and he says, how can you stand to live in a country where you pay such taxes? And the German businessman looks at him and says, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country. And that's why millionaires in California are more likely to stay in California if California raises taxes on them. Because the quality of life all around them goes up. They're less likely to bump into somebody on the street who's going to cough tuberculosis in their face. They're less likely to get mugged as they walk down the street. They're less likely, you know, even if they live in a bubble. The pool person is, you know, cleans their pool, or their butler is less likely to rob them because they live in a decent place. It's incredible. John in Olympia, Washington. Hey, John, what's up?
Good morning. I was listening to your thing this morning about the tolls.
Yeah.
And here in Washington State, it's a little bit different. There's two bridges that you have to pay a toll. One's the Tacoma Narrows and one's the 520 bridge up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to pay a toll. If you buy one of these electronic.
Yeah, the Easy Pass things.
Exactly. If you buy that, you can go through and not have, you know, pay the actual toll and take. So it's
but they bill you at the end of the month, or you pay in advance. I mean,
you pay in advance.
Yeah, those Easy Pass things. The state is not in some cases they give a slight discount if you get the Easy Pass, but then you got to pay for the Easy Pass. But it's really not a rich person's toll lane. It's really more like a committed commuter's toll lane.
Well, the reason I brought it up is I actually bought one of those for the two or three times a year I go across the bridge, and there's a highway called 167 that has an HOV lane that if you have one of those passes, you can pay anywhere from 25 cents to $1.25, depending on how bad the traffic is, to go in the HOV lane. And as a businessman who does quite a bit of driving around the Seattle area, you know, to me, 25 cents to $1.25 is not going to keep somebody out of that lane. I mean, even the really not well-off people I know can afford that. But I got to tell you, after hearing the talk this morning, I'm thinking that, okay, well, maybe I am being a little bit of an elitist.
Well, no, the question, what you're seeing is the camel's nose under the tent. You know, it's like, okay, that starts out, that sounds reasonable. Yeah, 25 cents, and I got the pass, and now I can use the lane. And then pretty soon it becomes $5, and I've got the pass, and I can use the lane. And then when it gets a little more congested, it becomes $10. And now the lane is filled with nothing but Lexuses and Mercedes. And
I'll be out of it at that point.
And what it is it's a step in the direction of a two-tiered society, a rich and an everybody else society. And that That is not historically the direction that Americans have gone. John, thank you very much for the call. James in Bourbonnais, Illinois, if I'm pronouncing that right. James?
Yeah, close enough. Good afternoon, Tom.
What's up?
I was calling about the guy talking about their rich person lane.
Right.
And the idea of just giving them a special lane is ridiculous, even if they're charging for it. I can tell you, being an over-the-road truck driver, tolls are ridiculous, and privatizing roads is not a good idea.
Right.
Indiana sold their toll road, which is I-80 and 90, mm-hmm. a couple of years back to a private corporation. It used to cost me $15 to drive my truck across there. It cost me over $30 2 days ago to drive across there.
Wow.
The road is getting worse every time I drive down it, and the tolls keep going higher.
Yeah.
Private corporations are not maintaining the roads. They don't care.
Yeah.
They're making their money. That's all they care about. And Indiana got a large chunk of money, which I'm glad they're happy about it. But no one's going to take the road if it keeps getting worse, and this corporation is going to not be very happy in
yeah.
the end.
It's the same thing with the privatized prisons. You know, they have higher rates of prisoner fatalities, higher rates of prisoner injuries, you know, less you know, quality nutrition for people, higher, you know, it's because their principal purpose is to make a buck. It's not to, and they don't, you know, reform people or, you know, what's the rehabilitate. Thank you, Shana. They don't rehabilitate people anywhere near as effectively as public prisons, because the public prisons have as the goal, the public good, which is, you know, rehabilitate somebody to get them back into the public. And the public good should be the question at issue here, not the well-being of a small number of very rich people. Excellent point, James. Thanks a lot for the call. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. I just would like to make this statement that, you know, we, since the turn of the 19th century, we've been controlled, and probably even the turn of the 20th century, we've been controlled by the economic system of the corporate elite. We get our food, our resources. Our food is controlled by the corporate elite. Our resources are controlled by the corporate elite. They're turning America into our military. Our military supply are controlled by the corporate elite.
Yeah.
They're turning America. I believe this is what I suggest, is that the corporation, we need them. We have to have them at this point in our lives.
Michael, do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I am over 50.
Okay, so you're old enough to remember America before Ronald Reagan's administration.
Yes.
Okay.
I wasn't aware, but I do remember it.
Now, if you remember back to the 1970s, the early 1980s, we had hundreds of food companies competing for our loyalties, and food was regulated, well-regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We had hundreds of pharmaceutical companies. There were, you know, in every, you know, radio and TV stations all around the country were all independently owned. Newspapers were independently owned. What I think that you're right. What we're seeing is the corporate takeover of America, but it's the consequence of Reagan in 1982 deciding to stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. And now what we have are these giant monopolies. We live in a monopoly state rather than a basically a real, genuine free market state. Michael, thank you for the call. Well said. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you're not old enough to remember what America was like before Ronald Reagan, ask somebody who is. You'll get an earful, I promise you. How much of our commons should we privatize? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tim in Cupertino, California. Hey, Tim, thoughts on HOT lanes, the high toll lanes?
Hi, Tom. I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called In Time starring Justin Timberlake, but
I have not.
The real quick basic premise is that everyone is paid with time and not money.
Oh, I did see that movie. That movie.
Right, so you know what happens to the mom when she tries to get home, she tries to get on a bus, and the cost of the bus is more than the amount of money she has
right.
on her, and she winds up dying because of it. And I think it's kind of a, you know, an issue with commons where if you can afford to take the HOV lane, then great, but if the commons are getting overcrowded, why don't we build more commons? I mean, if the freeway doesn't have enough lanes, build more freeway lanes. I mean, I know it'll take time and it'll take
money.
Or
offer an alternative, like high-speed rail.
Or yeah, and build high-speed rail, build alternatives.
Right.
This guy was just arguing that, you know, for, you know, giving people choice, but it would be better.
Well, it's giving rich people choices, because in order to have a choice, you have to have the means to have the choice. You have to be wealthy enough to have the choice.
Right, and I think if your listeners haven't seen that movie, that's a really good kind of, you know, here's a rich people society where if you don't have money, that's it.
You know, that movie was, it reminded me very much of Dickens's work. Charles Dickens' father was put into a debtor's prison, which is why he wrote the books he did. And as you recall, in his most famous book, and at least the most well-known in the United States, Christmas Carol, Bob Cratchit had a son named Tiny Tim who had a medical condition that was going to kill him. And at the very end, Scrooge stepped in and paid for it. Ebenezer Scrooge stepped in and paid for it to be fixed, you know, for Tiny Tim to have his medical care. But it's sort of like, hey, you're going to run out of time. Well, you run out of money, you run out of time too. And 40 to 50,000 Americans every year in the United States die because of lack of health insurance, for example. So, yeah, it's an excellent metaphor. Thank you very much, Tim. Excellent point. Bryce in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Bryce, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I'm comment on the lanes. I moved from Seattle. When I lived in Seattle, I had those lanes, and
Well, you had the HOV lanes. Did you have the HOT lanes?
Well, it's the where you pay the fee so you can go. You know, but you can use them.
So those are the HOT ones, the high toll ones. Okay.
Right.
All right.
And in reality, what I saw when I was there is it actually those lanes only go for a few miles.
Right.
They don't take you home, you know.
Yeah.
So what you do is a lot of times you get to the traffic jam quicker.
To the traffic jam, not around it. Okay.
Not around it, you know. You'd be very lucky if they went around it. But you know, you're still going to have a bottleneck someplace, excuse me. And and it kind of gets you there quicker.
Yeah.
So you're going to save 3-4 minutes.
Yeah. The question is whether we, at the end of the day, I think, Bryce, the real question is, is transportation part of the commons? And if so, do we collectively get together and figure out what's the best way to transport the largest number of people at the lowest cost and with the lowest carbon footprint? Or do we all get together and figure out what's the best way that rich people can transport themselves and have lots and lots of choices and everybody else gets screwed? And those are basically the two ends of the argument. Thank you very much, Bryce, for the call. Well said. Preston in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Preston, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, I think we definitely should not privatize things like the global food supply and water supplies as Monsanto.
They're aggressively being privatized right now.
That's right. And I also want to comment on unequal protection and thank you for that book. It's been a huge impact on my understanding of corporate power. And more recently, you had a part in the film Heist, Who Stole the American Dream?
Yes, I narrated
it. Also very important.
Yeah.
And, you know, Citizens United, that case revolved around a documentary that the right wing produced, a pseudo-documentary that was a hit piece on Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
And they've produced several documentaries, and they've got a couple out there that they've distributed millions of copies of that are very scurrilous and unfair pieces, attacks on Obama.
Yep.
And so I would suggest, again, that progressive people try to occupy the DVD players with good progressive documentaries.
There you go.
Like,
yeah, there's some great documentaries out there. Leonardo DiCaprio's The 11th Hour, which was inspired by my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. These are my personal favorites. That one, the Dalai Lama Renaissance, which is about a week that a group of us spent with the Dalai Lama, narrated by Harrison Ford. Go ahead.
And you've seen The Corporation, I'm sure.
Yeah, The Corporation is a brilliant one. Tom Shadyac has one called I Am, which is a little bit closer to the heart. It's about, you know, who are we as a people and how do we collaborate and cooperate with each other. But I think Tom Shadyac's I Am is one of the most brilliant pieces of filmmaking. He's the guy who did all the Jim Carrey movies, you know, the Bruce Almighty and all that kind of stuff. And he had a life-changing experience. He nearly died. He was in a bike accident. And out of that, he made this movie, I Am, which is just brilliant. Preston, thank you for the call. I got to move along here. There's a lot of folks want to get in on this. Mike, in Middleton, Idaho. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I haven't talked to you in a while. Love the show. I've been listening to you since the last election cycle.
Wow.
I get a lot of good information, and I'm able to refute some of the Fox nuts.
Good.
Anyway, you were talking about tolls. I missed the first 45 minutes of the show, but I just heard tolls come up, and these tolls are getting – there's a couple of things. For one, Indiana With their tolls, it's up to $32 now. I just crossed there yesterday or day before yesterday. Anyway, they went to machines. Not only do they keep raising the price of the tolls and they don't put it back into the road, they're cutting jobs and putting machines where you feed the ticket in and you feed the money in. And if you want a receipt, you have to push another button. Well, my business, driving truck, if I forget to hit the button, well, I don't get a receipt and I don't get that money back. But right. I did get one over a couple of times on Indiana. The first time it was a machine and I didn't get a receipt, but the second and third times, it counted me as a car. So I only paid like $7.25 to cross the entire state of Indiana.
Okay.
So,
but this whole thing of raising fees, I mean, this is how Mitt Romney got around raising taxes in Massachusetts. He raised over 900 fees. He raised fees, you know, you want to be a hairdresser? The fee goes up. You know, you want to be a barber? The fee goes up. You want this long, long list of them. And this is just another example of raising the cost and then not putting it into the roads. It's a tragedy. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And keep on trucking, brother. We'll be back. Peter Farrar is going to drop by. We're going to talk about the feudal lords and their occupancy of our democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, if you live in Pennsylvania, you probably don't know about this, although maybe you heard about it around the edges. But the legislature has passed a law which allows your employer, if they meet certain conditions, they have to employ more than 250 people. In other words, it has to be a big corporation. Screw the little guys, right? That allows your employer to take that state income tax that is deducted from your paycheck every week, that at the end of the year you get the statement, or every paycheck you get the statement, and says, oh, you know, $28.35 or $212.60, whatever it is, went to state income taxes, allows your employer to keep 95% of that. Just keep it. Use it to jack up their CEO's pay. Now, why would Pennsylvania do this? Well, 19 states have actually done this. It's costing all of us collectively $684 million a year. $684 million a year is being stolen from workers across America who think they're paying state taxes so that they can have things like the state police and, like, you know, highways and you know, good commons and whatnot. And instead is being stolen from them and given to corporate fat cats. This is the big new trend. In fact, this is, quote, stealthy by design. As David K. Johnston writes in his new book, Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. It also allows your employer to confiscate your tax withholdings and donate them to pro-Romney super PACs, and to even require you to show up for all-day training sessions. One employer in the United States with 40,000 employees is doing one now called Civics 101. It's a program that was written by a foundation funded by the Koch brothers that teaches people about civics. Right. Using your state tax withholding. Here to defend this practice is Peter Farrar, senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy, the CCPP.org. Peter, this seems insane to me.
Well, I'm not here to defend it. I don't know why you would say that. I don't even understand what they're doing. But obviously, the money that's taken from workers' paychecks is still credited to the state as their payments. Whether the state decides to let the companies keep it, I don't know why they would do that.
Well, they would do that because the states...
reason, but I haven't heard what the reason is.
The reason is very simple. The corporations are going to the states and they're saying, if you don't do this for us, we're going to move to another state that will.
Oh, I understand. Well, that's a terrible policy. That's a terrible policy. It's a terribly stupid policy.
Wow.
It's a terribly stupid policy.
Peter, I think I've stepped into an alternative universe. You and I are agreeing?
Yes, and I'll tell you why it's a stupid policy. All these advantages they do where they cut deals with companies, you stay here and we'll give you a break on your taxes.
Right.
That's crony capitalism. That's a special interest favoritism.
I agree.
And it doesn't promote economic growth.
I agree.
It distributes companies from one place to another, creates a bidding war. Move companies from one place to another.
So why don't you tell your Republican colleagues to stop pushing this kind of legislation? Because this is, in virtually every single case, this is coming out of Republican legislatures.
Well, I think that's exactly what you got out of Illinois. This is really not Republican Party policy because it's anti-market, because it's a form of central government planning because it favors particular companies over others.
Well, no, the argument is that it's free market competition. It's states competing with each other for business.
Let me explain my position. But it doesn't help. That's not the way you promote economic growth. What you want to do is have general incentives open to everybody, the same policy open to everybody. And then this is the most efficient and effective program that have the same incentives and policies open to everybody, and let the markets and the competition decide who succeeds and who fails. Not have the government say, "Well, I'll cut a special deal with you if you stay here, or I'll cut a special deal with you if you move your company there." That doesn't promote economic growth. That just creates a bidding war for particular companies, and it is very wasteful and counterproductive. So
right, and it's costing the taxpayers of this country hundreds of millions, billions, tens of billions of dollars a year. And you know, Bernie Sanders proposed some years ago that any state that allows this sort of thing to happen within their state boundaries should lose their federal highway dollars. Can you think of a better way to stop this from happening?
I'd be all in favor of that because this is very bad policy. It's very anti-market policy. Free market policy is you have the same incentives for everybody, and then you let the consumers decide which companies succeed and which fails. You let the markets decide. You let competition decide. You don't cut special deals with particular people. That ends up making everybody poorer.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a general incentive, you have low tax rates, only regulations that are necessary, and you have a sound dollar, you're going to create, it always works. You create a huge economic boom. It's really forcing.
But actually, no, it doesn't always work. I'm looking for this thing. I know Louise just handed it to me and I walked in here with it, but I don't know where it went to. Or maybe she didn't hand it to me. If she didn't, tell her to bring it to me.
Well,
but the Congressional Budget Office did this evaluation. I believe it was the CBO did this evaluation of you know, whether lowering taxes stimulates economic activity, found that it doesn't. And in fact, the times when our country has had the greatest economic activity are the times when we've had the highest taxes. And the Republicans said, you've got to pull that. It's got pulled. And now you've got, you know, senators, Democratic senators saying, wait a minute, you know, good science was pulled because of Republican pressure. There is no evidence that lower taxes increase economic activity.
What you just said, there's not a single economic theory or economist who believes in that view. Even under Keynesian economics, reducing taxes promotes economic growth. Let me finish this point. The key is you have to cut tax rates. That's the only tax cut that works. It has to be rates. But even under Keynesian economics, tax cuts are expansionary. Even Karl Marx never said that higher tax rates promote economic growth. So there's no economist who ever said higher tax rates promote economic growth.
Well, I strongly disagree. There are a number of them, and I'd start with David K. Johnson, who's won the Pulitzer Prize. Ask yourself a really simple question, Peter. Back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, when we had the strongest economic growth in the history of the United States and arguably in the history of the world, although China is eclipsing that rapidly now with state-run capitalism, but during that period of time, the top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires was 91% during most of it, 74% during the last decade or so of it. And corporations were paying 34% of the total federal load. They're now paying 9%, and the top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires now in the United States is 15%, is what Romney pays. We've been screwed. The economy's gone to hell. The average worker over the last 30 years of Reaganomics has seen their wages go down. And I would say that if we repealed the Reagan tax cuts and went back to that 74% top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires, you would see economic activity increase because there'd be less of this insane gambling with all this hot money.
That can work if you do one thing along with that economic policy. You have to bomb the smithereens every major economic competitor, as we had done in the 1950s.
No, it's not true.
If you can do that, that policy.
We had economic competitors all over the world. Peter, the percentage of our GDP that was represented by international trade before World War II was a little over 3%. After World War II, it was a little under 3%. World War II, our ability to sell things to the rest of the world did not, you know, that is not how we made our money. We made our money selling things to ourselves. And the reason we were selling things to ourselves is because under the policies of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, and Dwight Eisenhower, people had good union jobs, wages went up, a middle class emerged. That middle class wanted goods and services, and so entrepreneurs stepped forward and said, we'll make these things for you.
We were selling things to ourselves because all our major competitors were bombed smithereens, so there's nobody else to sell.
We were selling things to ourselves before World War II, too.
And
we were not. Imports were 3% of GDP before World War II, Peter. It was not a big deal. It's not like today where, you know, you can't find anything made.
No competition to challenge any of us at all. So yeah. You could tax smithereens out of anybody, but because there was nobody who could compete with us.
Okay. Peter Ferrara, the Carlson Center for Public Policies, the CCPP. Thank you, Peter.
Welcome.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
At least we agreed that it's crazy that these states are taking money out of your paycheck. Excuse me, these companies in these states are taking money out of your paycheck and keeping it. Okay, I found it. I got too much damn paper on my desk. Here it is. Economist stands by tax cut study after GOP successfully demands its withdrawal. The author of a Congressional Research Service study, this from TMP, Shahil Kapoor, writing for TMP DC, Talking Points Memo. The author of a Congressional Research Service study, which found no evidence that tax cuts for high-income earners lead to economic growth, is standing by his work after the legislative branch's nonpartisan research arm withdrew the report under pressure from Republican leaders. And now the Democrats want to know why. Senator Sandra Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, top tax writing Democrat in the House, wants the CRS, the Congressional Research Service, to explain. They got some splaining to do. Apparently it was Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Finance Committee Ranking Member Orrin Hatch who were all upset. Oh, the Congressional Research Service did a study, and it doesn't show that when you cut taxes on rich people, that it helps the economy. We can't have that. Withdraw it. But the author of the report is saying, Thomas Hungerford, the author of the study, told TPM in an email Thursday afternoon, I certainly stand behind my work. And Senator Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, is saying, I was deeply disturbed to hear that Mr. Hungerford's report was taken down in response to political pressure from congressional Republicans who have an ideological objection to the report's findings, factual findings, and conclusions. You know, what this really says is it's just another example of how Republicans do not live in a fact-based world. Global warming. Oh, it's a hoax, didn't you know? Somebody just made it up. It's a hoax. It's a scam for environmentalists to keep their jobs. Jobs? Really? You can make money being an environmentalist? I know you can make good money being an oil company, not paying taxes, getting government subsidies, you know, owning a coal company. Tell your people they got to stand up behind Mitt Romney for a photo op or they'll you might not have a job tomorrow, you know. But, you know, the fact-based world is not one that the Republicans are comfortable in. Women actually can get pregnant from rape. Yeah, about 30,000 of them a year in the United States, and that may be a conservative number. Oh, but they've got special magical hormones or something that stop that. If it's a real rape or a forcible, I mean, it's not the fact-based world that the Republicans live in. Global climate change. Nothing to worry about. Mercury in the air, you know, from the which is mostly coming from the coal-fired power plants and secondarily coming out of our exhaust pipes in our cars and diesel trucks, in particular diesel. Oh, yeah, well, you know, it's just fine. It's no big deal. A little mercury won't kill you. Actually, it will, but. In fact, as Mayor Bloomberg pointed out in his endorsement today of President Obama, coal-fired power plants kill 15,000 Americans every year. By virtue of their pollution. And I thought it was particularly ironic that the mayor in his endorsement of Obama. That Mayor Bloomberg said, you know, Mitt Romney used to take this position. Mitt Romney actually promoted, passed, and signed cap and trade legislation in Massachusetts on fossil fuels, carbon dioxide. But now he doesn't take that position anymore, so I'm not going to endorse him, says Mayor Bloomberg, who's, you know, a billionaire. I mean, he's more Republican than Democrat by a long shot. But Mitt Romney, nah, don't think so. I told you that I was going to tell you about this Grover Cleveland hurricane story. I don't know if you've seen this. Matthew Algeo, A-L-G-E-O, Algeo, I'm not sure how he pronounces his last name, wrote an op-ed that's published in today's New York Times, or yesterday's New York Times, titled Grover Cleveland's Hurricane. I did not know about this. In 1893, Grover Cleveland was president of the United States. It was actually his second term. He was the only Democrat to serve in the White House after Reconstruction until Woodrow Wilson, I believe. And Grover Cleveland was, you know, back in those days, the Democrats, well, how do you say it? This was during the robber baron era. They were pretty much as corrupt as the Republicans. Just say it truthfully. And Grover Cleveland, there were these, in August, there were four hurricanes out in the Atlantic. Two of them petered out. Two of them came on shore. One near Savannah, Georgia. The other slammed into New York City. 30 people were killed in New York City. 2,000 people were killed down in Georgia. And as Matthew Algeo, assuming I'm pronouncing it right, writes, in the wake of these twin tragedies, however, President Grover Cleveland did nothing. Why? Because he said it would be paternalistic. It would be paternalistic. He said, Cleveland, this is what he said when he vetoed $10,000 for drought-stricken farmers in Texas. He said, federal aid in such cases encourages the expectation of paternal care on the part of the government and weakens the sturdiness of our national character. As a consequence of this, now, keep in mind, back in that day, you could run for president 3, 4, 5 times. FDR ran 4 times and won every single time. It was only after FDR's presidency that the Republicans got the Constitution amended so you could only run twice. And then they regretted that after the Reagan presidency. And in any case, Grover Cleveland wanted to run for president again, but his own party. In fact, in his own party, he was booed more than McKinley, the Republican, was. Because he didn't stand up to help out the storm victims. You wonder why Chris Christie's out there holding hands with Barack Obama? Maybe it has something to do with knowing that he's going to have to answer to the voters next year when he runs for re-election. Maybe it has something to do with actually caring about the people in his state. Of course, you got Rush Limbaugh calling him calling him fat and an idiot now. Wow, that's pretty rough. Coming from Limbaugh?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So Clara Barton stepped in. She had just founded the Red Cross. But it really wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. And Grover Cleveland lost. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the major superstars in the Democratic Party right now is Julian Castro, the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, seventh largest city in the United States. He delivered the keynote address at this year's DNC, which was absolutely brilliant. Mayor Castro, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Get out the vote effort. Tell us about what's being done nationwide by the Democratic Party and the Obama campaign to get out the vote.
Well, as you know, the Obama campaign now, not just in this cycle, but in the 08 cycle, has really established a great grassroots network of folks in local communities who are out there knocking on doors, making millions of phone calls, literally millions of phone calls now, particularly in these swing states, to remind folks to go out and vote early, if early voting is still happening in their state, or, of course, to vote on Election Day. All of that is animated by the fact that we remember election night 2000 and waiting up late into the night and watching the networks call it for Vice President Gore and then flipping that over and then the nation having to wait almost 40 days to find out that 537 votes made the difference.
Right.
So everyone remembers that, and we know that every vote counts, and there's an entire network of Obama campaign volunteers, as well as, of course, our labor community and others that are working on that.
Right. As I'm sure you know, one of the reasons why that vote was so close in Florida was because Kathleen Harris and Jeb Bush had knocked somewhere between 60 and 80,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls in Florida because they had names that were similar to the names of felons from the state that you live in, Texas. And largely African-Americans made it close enough to steal. There have been enormous, incredible voter suppression efforts across the United States. This is something that was championed by Paul Weyrich, the guy who ran Ronald Reagan's direct mail campaign and founded the American Legislative Exchange Council, Paul Ray, which has written most of these voter suppression laws. He was the also he worked on the both Bush campaigns. He just passed away a year or so ago. But here's Paul Weyrich in 1980 speaking to a group of Republican activists in a church about the Republican strategy to win elections in the coming decades.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And now we're hearing that the Romney campaign is having their poll watchers, is giving their poll watchers literally wrong information to challenge people, asking them, you know, for different kinds of ID than they actually need in several states, in Wisconsin, apparently in Ohio. What is the Democratic Party doing about this concerted, you know, this 30-year effort by the Republican Party to strip Democrats of their right to vote?
Well, first let me say that I agree with you that there has been a very clear agenda on that side to disenfranchise people, whether it's through legislation, all these voter ID bills that we've seen, or through, you know, what we would consider dirty tricks like misinforming folks, as you just mentioned, or the example in Arizona where the Spanish language information had the wrong election date on it. They put November 8th twice instead of November 6th.
Right.
And one of the things that the Democratic Party has done over the years is to deploy a group of volunteer lawyers, in especially in these important swing states, to try and combat that and give out the right information, as well as printing materials that are correct and trying to get that through the grapevine. And in certain occasions, even going on the air, on the radio, or putting ads in newspapers to try and correct it. But it's a constant battle because it is a very clear agenda on the other side. What I believe that Democrats should do is try and run the table the other way. For instance, here in Texas, we don't have same-day voter registration. In some states, you can show up and get registered the same day that you vote.
Right. You need to get that.
That should be the case everywhere.
Yeah.
And high school principals ought to be empowered to help register every single kid that turns 18 when they're a senior.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that I think the Democrats should really put a lot of emphasis on in conjunction with nonprofits and foundations that contribute to voter registration drives in general, and in state legislatures where Democrats have sway, unlike here in Texas where it's Republican-controlled and you're never going to get that kind of legislation through there.
Right. Agreed. And I would submit also that we need an affirmative constitutional right to vote. You know, there are individual groups who have the right to vote, but not, you know, there's not a, at least according to the Supreme Court in their Bush v. Gore ruling, there is not an affirmative right to vote for president of the United States, and which allows a lot of this stuff to happen, frankly, without the federal government being able to stop it. I just find it astounding. One of the things we're talking with Mayor Julian Castro of the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, and the keynoter at the DNC. One of the many calls that we get into this program, a number of people have called in, said they went in for early voting, and in the process of early voting discovered that their registration had been flipped from Democratic to Republican, or their address had been changed to something that wasn't their actual address, or they had actually even been purged from the voter rolls. And because they showed up for early voting, they were able to then to go back home, get the necessary identification for the re-registration process, come back the next day, register to vote, and have their vote counted. But they had been the victims of these Republican dirty tricks that have been going on for year after year after year. Is that not a strong argument in favor of showing up early rather than on election day?
Oh, it absolutely is. And, you know, I encourage everyone, just like anyone out there right now would, to show up to early voting. Hopefully if there is an issue like that, you can get it cleared up there on site, or at least in time for you to go and vote or file a provisional ballot, which is also an option in a lot of states. But you never know what's going to happen on election day.
Mm-hmm.
You never know what might keep you from the poll if you wait until Tuesday.
Right.
So it makes all the sense in the world to get out there and vote early. And it is absolutely amazing, how little we invest as a nation and per state in the infrastructure of what is the most important component of our democracy, voting.
Yeah. Well, not only do we not invest in it, but we've privatized it. I mean, we've turned it over to private for-profit corporations, which just makes me insane. Not because I'm asserting that there's any, they're rigging the election kind of thing. I suppose I could make that case, but really just the idea that we've privatized the beating heart of democracy, to paraphrase Thomas Paine, seems to me crazy. I remember the old mechanical voting machines. They were actually owned by the government. Yeah, they were made by private corporations, but they were owned by governments. So.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that's been fascinating to me is, I'll ask folks who don't vote regularly, who never vote, why don't you vote? And folks always say that they don't think their vote is going to make a difference. And, you know, you try and tell them that it will.
Mm-hmm.
But they also say that they don't understand how to use the machinery.
Hmm.
They're embarrassed about the idea of getting in there and being lost. And so I think educating folks when they're in school, I mean, at a very basic level,
mm-hmm.
about how you do this stuff,
right.
can make a big difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's, I would say that's a good point for going back to paper, paper ballots.
I guess that's fairly straightforward. Yeah.
Fill in the circle. So, Mayor Castro, in your mind, first of all, I'm curious your take on, Mayor Bloomberg just came out and endorsed Barack Obama, President Obama. And in doing so, he spoke well of Governor Romney back when he was the governor, when he put into place a cap and trade program in Massachusetts. Argued for it, fought for it, signed it into law, and now has taken the exact opposite position and is in bed with the coal and oil companies and whatnot. The reason for endorsing President Obama was his concern about global warming. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm glad to see Mayor Bloomberg support President Obama in his statement. He did, of course, mention their common views on climate change, and he also, I think, has in the past, and I think today as well, voiced confidence in the president's leadership. I think he understands, like many folks, that he's a strong leader, that the nation has made progress under President Obama, that the economy has gotten better, that there's a great track record there to stand on its own. And so I'm glad to see him do it, just like General Powell.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that General Powell, someone who has been around people in politics and people in the military and in business for many years, is a good judge of folks, has come to the conclusion that President Obama is the right leader for these times. And you mentioned Mayor Bloomberg's assessment of Mitt Romney. You know, I think he voiced what a lot of us are thinking. You know, which Mitt Romney is this?
Mm-hmm.
What does a guy really believe? You can't tell what he really stands for.
Right. And even worse, which, if he becomes president, God forbid, which Mitt Romney would that be?
That's true. And what's been so somewhat amusing, if it weren't so sad, is the way that a lot of these Republicans have embraced Mitt Romney here at the end, when 8 years ago, they were calling John Kerry a flip-flopper
right.
And saying that he didn't stand for anything. Well, they have a prime example. That wasn't true back then, but it is true now.
Yeah, John Kerry was quite consistent on the issues. I mean, that was one of those manufactured phony outrage things. Mayor Julian Castro of San Antonio, Texas, BarackObama.com, of course, the Obama campaign. Sir, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It is an honor to talk with you, and that was one hell of a speech you gave. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. We will be back.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Ain't that news? Well, yeah, I guess it is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the news with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. Get to free-don.org now and check it out. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has endorsed in this election, saying, among other things, in a lengthy endorsement on his website, "When I step into the voting booth, I think about the world I want to leave my two daughters." And this is after he has been extremely critical of the person he goes ahead and endorsed. And the values that are required to guide us there, the two parties' nominees for president offer differing visions. And he goes on and talks about a woman's right to choose, marriage equality, and climate change. And in fact, climate change seems to be the tipping point for him. And on those three issues, he says he endorses President Obama for a second term.
So Mayor Bloomberg is actually making an endorsement based on the issues rather than ideology or politics.
Yes, very much on the issues, and really bringing climate change to the fore. His opening is the devastation that Hurricane Sandy brought to New York City and much of the Northeast brought the stakes of Tuesday's presidential election into sharp relief. And he talks about our climate is changing and that it should compel all elected leaders to take immediate action.
Wow.
He talks about climate change very vociferously in this endorsement and brings the issue of climate change to the fore in a way that no other politician has done in this race.
Yeah, you know, I find it very interesting. I used to regularly debate Mark Morano and others on climate change on this program. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, they kind of all vanished. They've become very scarce. But it's like the politicians don't know that they've all vanished, and they still live in fear of raising the climate change specter. And I saw a news program the other day where the person said, well, you know, I realize there's a big debate about climate change, and actually there's no debate. You know, I mean, the debate's over. But you know, could this be, might this be the thing that tips it over the top that causes us to actually start having climate change policy in the United States?
Well, I think this is his gamble.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is what he's gambling on. And I think if any politician in the country can do it and can afford to take the risk, because what does he care? He can, and I think that's exactly what he's doing.
Right.
And in his response, President Obama, in his statement, it says that he's honored and how much he deeply respects him, and he mentions those issues. He also mentions immigration reform. He also says that climate change is a threat to our children's future, and we owe it to them to do something about it. One of the rare times that he's actually mentioned that issue in the campaign.
Yeah, interesting. What else is up?
Endorsements today from The Economist magazine, a very influential magazine internationally,
mm-hmm.
Says America could do better than Barack Obama. Sadly, Mitt Romney does not fit the bill.
Wow, The Economist is like, that's a very conservative magazine.
Right, a magazine I read, and a six-page analysis of why it endorses Barack Obama and not Mitt Romney. Very, very interesting. Well worth the read.
Wow. Wow. That's a big deal.
It's a very big deal.
That's, I mean, you know, you read The Economist, I read The Economist, but the largest slice of readership is the millionaires and billionaires. I mean, they religiously read The Economist.
Exactly. And The Economist in this endorsement goes into why Mitt Romney is actually not good for business.
Fascinating.
Very interesting. Also today, the group hosting international election observers said but state officials in Iowa and Texas are needlessly blocking access to the decades-old process the United States has already agreed to. We're talking about the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is coming to the United States with 44 observers in different states to observe our elections.
Right.
It says it will abide by election laws after officials in both Iowa and Texas warned about possible criminal prosecution if the observers come within hundreds of feet of polling places. We will, of course, comply, a spokesman said. At the same time, the lack of access to polling stations for international observers in some states is not in line with the United States' international commitments. And we have noted this in past final reports issued by observation missions.
Right. So we require other countries, if we're going to certify or assert that their elections were fair and honest, we require them to have fairly transparent balloting. We don't have that here in many states. In fact, we ban it. And we're somehow trumpeting this. Rick Perry down in Texas, you know, you come within 100 yards of my polling place and I'll come out with my shotgun, you know, get off my porch.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what is being said. And they experienced this in the 2008 general election. In their report, they said that election observers were turned away from polling stations in Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, and Texas. And their poll watchers also had difficulties in counties in Colorado, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
Remarkable.
Very interesting indeed. The election campaign got back into full swing today, first time it did after Superstorm Sandy. President Obama, by and large, talking about unity, saying we mourn the loss of so many people. In the end, we're all in this together, that we rise and fall as one nation, one people. Mitt Romney is going on the attack on the president over the president's call for a secretary of business, which Romney is saying will add to his cabinet. Actually, it won't, just to consolidate, saying that he doesn't think that we need one, because what instead is we need a president with experience in business.
So, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. Tell me if I am understanding this correctly.
Yes.
President Obama says, let's consolidate a couple of cabinet positions. Let's actually reduce the number of cabinet positions and create a secretary of business. And Mitt Romney lies about it and says that Obama wants to add one?
Yes.
Amazing. He can't even make what could be an honest criticism without telling a lie. I'm astounded. Anyhow, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Check out free-don.org for the plight of Don Siegelman so you can sign the petition to President Obama asking him to pardon this victim of Karl Rove's dirty tricks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, a lot going on today. I think Mayor Bloomberg's endorsement of Obama is a big deal. But, and The Economist, the British-based international economics, very conservative economics magazine, endorsing Obama, that's a big deal. But Nate Silver betting Joe Scarborough $1,000 is the biggest deal. In fact, I've been looking at Intrade, and I don't know if there's a, you know, cause effect correlation here, but at the beginning of the day, as I recall, now I could be wrong on this. I should probably pull up the graphic, you know, the chart. But my recollection is that at the beginning of the day, Obama was running around 63% that he's going to win, and right now it is 66.1%. Now, this is just bettors. You know, these are people betting. This is the British gambling site, so we'll see. New study by the Congressional Research Service says, no, tax cuts for rich people do not stimulate economic growth. Never have, never will, no way, forget it. Republicans lean on the Congressional Research Service very heavily. Now, the Congressional Research Service, just so you know, is an agency that is there to provide unbiased, factual, actual information to members of Congress. I didn't even know it existed until 1999, I think it was. I was writing what became the book on equal protection. And Jim Jeffords was the senator from Vermont at the time, and Louise and I were living in Vermont. And he was a Republican at that time, in fact. And actually, this must have been 2001, now that I think about it, because it was the Bush administration that was pushing this. So it must have been just after the elections. And I went to Jeffords' office and I said his big issue was education. And he was pulling his support as a Republican. He went from Republican to independent, which threw the Senate into the hands of the Democrats for a short period of time. And there were bumper stickers all over Vermont that said, "Thanks, Jim," and stuff like that. And I said, what was it that did this? And his office shared with me, I couldn't walk off with it, but I could sit there and read it, a Congressional Research Service report that was, they provide these to members of Congress, not to the public, but to members of Congress, that basically said that the No Child Left Behind program would basically only have one major effect, and that was to turn a multi-$100 million a year educational testing industry into a multi-billion dollar a year educational testing industry. And of course, George W. Bush was president and his brother Neil was heavily invested. He had started up a company for educational testing. In fact, when Katrina happened, Barbara Bush, his mother, donated her donation for Katrina to her son Neil's educational testing charity with the stipulation that it be used in New Orleans. So this was theoretically a donation to Louisiana. Yes, we'll give you some of Neil's tests. But anyhow, this is the research arm of Congress. And their job is not to promote anybody's political point of view, but to simply find the facts. And they were tasked with that job. I don't know who asked them to do it. Perhaps a Republican. Do tax cuts on rich people stimulate economic growth? And the Congressional Research Service came back and said no. And so the Republicans said, pull the study. And now Sander Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, the congressman from Michigan, is saying, hey, wait a minute. He's the top tax-rating Democrat in the House. He says, you pulled this study? I mean, this requires an explanation. This is not right. So I find this absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. A lot of issues in the air. Mayor Bloomberg saying climate change is what it's all about. Arthur in Homewood, Illinois, wants to disagree on that. Hey, Arthur, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, sir. I listen to you quite often. I don't agree with you, maybe sometimes. But I've been studying volcanoes ever since this man-made global warming. I believe in global warming, but that's through the sun and through nature. And I read in volcanoes, and this one caught my eye. And I'm going to see if I pronounce it correctly, because I'm not quite as esteemed as you are, sir. It's called Krakatoa, K-R-A-K-A-T-U-A, was erupted in 1883.
Yep.
It caused the Earth 3 degrees in temperature drop.
Yeah, it did. And this is because it increased the albedo effect. It threw so much particulate matter into the air that it reflected sunlight out.
And we're still here. And this, now, when Katrina...
That was a 1 to 2 year change in temperature. First
that's
of all,
right here,
secondly, have you if you're interested in albedo effect, have you looked at the studies of the weeks on either side of 9/11?
No. I'm just about
there's a real interesting argument to be made, Arthur.
The two men that wrote these books.
Arthur, can you hear me?
Wants to look it up. It's Zelinga Deborah and Donald Theodore Sanders.
Right.
They're quite knowledgeable. Now, when South Main Mount St. Helen, when she erupted, 200,000 tons of carbon went into the air every second. Now, you tell me this should be devastating. See, nature takes care of itself.
Yeah.
See, even the oil spills that was spilled in.
We are putting hundreds of billions.
I'm looking at books.
Of carbon dioxide into the air. Well, you might want to look at more than just that one book. Arthur, you're not arguing with me. You're arguing with the world's leading climate scientists. Thank you for the call. You've got one nice, interesting book, as I said, if you wanted to actually have a conversation about this, the albedo effect, the effect of reflection of the Earth's surface, right now there's an argument to be made that the world should be warmer than it is, but it isn't because there's so many jets flying in the stratosphere, leaving behind, you know, ice crystals, water vapor crystals, and that those water vapor crystals are reflecting light off the, you know, off the surface or, you know, out of the upper atmosphere. So, I don't know. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I would just, first of all, I am a diehard progressive, and I've already voted. I am not a right-wing wing nut. That being said, I would like to respectfully disagree with something you said earlier.
Okay.
And that is regarding the mercury emissions from trucks. That is true of old trucks.
Okay.
Since 2004, then 2007, and especially the 2010 trucks and newer are zero emissions trucks.
At least with regard to mercury.
And particulate matter. Here is the studies. The new trucks starting from 2010 or newer.
Right.
The air coming out is actually cleaner than the air going into those trucks. It's actually cleaning the air. They also did a second study.
You wouldn't want to breathe truck exhaust, would you, Margie?
There are no stacks on new trucks anymore.
There's got to be exhaust. There has to be exhaust.
Take a look at the EPA standards. This is required.
Yeah, well, the particulate matter may be down, but all of the high fractions that are the result of burning petroleum products, you're still going to have a lot of poisons coming out of that thing.
At the NOx is done. It's from the diesel exhaust filters, which puts urea in it. I would just like you to take a look at it. The trucks, it's, like I said, I am not a right-wing wingnut. I am a truck driver.
Okay. I will check it out, Margie. I know that trucks have gotten a lot cleaner. Diesel, you know, in general, and diesel cars as well have gotten a lot cleaner, over the years, and that technology has improved. I still don't think I'd want to be breathing the output, you know, of any internal combustion engine that runs on fossil fuels, but point taken. Thank you very much for the call. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed. And back with more of your thoughts, my thoughts, the news of the day, right after this.
We take care of our home, wherever the flag's flown. We take care of our home.
Hey, that's the essence of America. I mean, it really is. This is the essence of America, is that we take care of our own. This is something I find just absolutely astounding about the modern political landscape. And maybe this has something to do with Strauss and Howe's theory that, you know, every 80 years things, you know, what was here comes back around again. These four generations, that there's a generation that experiences war and economic collapse. Actually, economic collapse creates war. And then they produce a generation that quietly and slowly builds the nation. And then they produce a generation that says, well, you know, what did we get out of that? We want spiritual enlightenment, and we're going to rebel against the establishment. And then they produce a generation that says, well, our parents were all, you know, we're getting higher, staring at their navels and all interested in enlightenment, but that didn't get them anywhere, so we're just going to get rich. And then that fourth generation, in their efforts to get rich, creates another economic crisis, which brings about another war, and it starts all over again. So it could be just, you know, we're in the, what, fourth cycle of this? 80 years ago now was the Great Depression and the World War II. 80 years before that was the Depression of 1857, the Panic of 1857, and the Civil War. 80 years before that was the Panic of the late 1870s, or 1860s, rather, and the Boston Tea Party of, 1760s. and the Boston Tea Party of 1773. They bought the Revolution of 1776. 80 years before that was a major depression in the 1680s and a war in the 1690s here in North America. I mean, you can read all this in the book is called The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe, but we had this debate about strong states versus a strong federal government in 1787. We won the Revolutionary War. We had 13 states. The states were connected by this thing called the Articles of Confederation, which gave all the power to the states. The federal government did not have the power to raise taxes. It did not have the power to spend money from taxes that were raised. It did not have the power to tax or regulate commerce between the states. It did not have, you know, virtually any of the powers that the federal government has now, other than just being, you know, a collective commonwealth of states. But the states had all the power. We had three presidents under the Articles of Confederation before George Washington. Three. I can't remember their names. I'll bet you never learned them either. But we had three presidents before George Washington when we were operating under the Articles of Confederation during and after the Revolutionary War. And then we all figured out, you know, this strong state, weak federal government thing ain't working. And a group emerged called the Federalists who said, let's create a strong federal government. Now, there was an opposite group called the Anti-Federalists who said, no, let's stay with the Articles of Confederation. Now, this was prior to the Constitution being worked out. And there was this big fight between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And the Federalists came up with a Constitution. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, his mentor, Thomas Jefferson, who kind of started out as an Anti-Federalist and ended up certainly a very strong Anti-Federalist, because the Federalists, by the time of the Adams presidency, had just become the corrupt establishment. But in any case, the Federalists won. In 1787, the Constitution was put forward. In 1789, it was ratified by three-quarters of the states, and boom. We became the United States of America as a federal republic, a constitutionally limited, democratic, representative, federalist republic. And then, 80 years later, there was a challenge to that. There was a group of people down in the South who said, you know, we don't want to live under the thumb of Washington, D.C., and their buddies up in the northern states, the more powerful states. So we're just going to secede. We're going to withdraw from the Union. And Lincoln said, no, not so fast. And we had this thing called the Civil War. And then 80 years after that, in the 1920s, in the election of 1920, in fact, you had President Harding. Actually, he was candidate Harding at the time. Run on the platform of literally this was his platform: more business in government, less government in business. In other words, he was running on a platform of small government. Harding won the election. He immediately dropped the top tax rate from 75% down to 25% on rich people, lowered corporate taxes, deregulated things. And it kicked off this, you know, all this hot money flooded in. This is what happens when you lower taxes like this. All this hot money flooded in, and it kicked off an era of wild real estate and stock speculation that ran for about 6 years in the real estate market until 1926, 27. And then the bubble in the stock market, that bubble burst in 27 and in a big way, starting in Florida. And then the stock market bubble burst in October of 1929. And so here we are roughly 80 years later, after the Great Depression and World War II, and again we've got these guys saying, where are the enumerated powers, and what about the 10th Amendment and states' rights, and we need to go back to weak federal government, strong states. You know, we litigated that with the Civil War. We tried that in the 1920s. It led to a national disaster called the Great Depression. We litigated that in the 1780s. And the Federalists in every case have won, and the Anti-Federalists in every case have lost, the states' rightsers. They've lost. The George Wallaces, the Lester Maddoxes, the Tom Coburns, the John Kyles, the Paul Ryans. They've lost every time. And now Mitt Romney's trying to cast himself as one of them. Less government and business, more business and government. Right. It worked really well in the 20s. It's just, I just find it remarkable that we keep re-litigating this thing every 80 years. I just find it amazing. I don't know what to add to that, but I think it's an interesting point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Although it's gotten more nuanced because these anti-federalists, they say they don't want the federal government telling them to, you know, paying taxes by getting taxes, but they do want them telling women what to do. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very murderously ugly. The good. Salina High School students. Last week, two students at the school wore shirts that said Lesbian 1 and Lesbian 2, but both were forced to remove the shirts. In response, over 20 students went to school on Tuesday with shirts that read, I support, express yourself, and straight by supportive, or straight butt supportive. These students were also told to remove the shirts, and those who didn't were given detention. Salina school officials tried to explain the blatant attack on freedom of speech by saying that the shirts were distracting to the education process. Students are now considering suing the school, which routinely allows students to wear shirts in support of pro-life causes and other politically based issues that would be just as distracting. Kudos to the Salina students for standing up for equal rights for the LGBT community. The bad. Conservative pundits. How dare a Republican praise President Obama? Or at least that's what conservative pundits were saying yesterday after New Jersey Governor Chris Christie heaped praise on President Obama for his handling of Hurricane Sandy. After touring damaged parts of his state, Christie said, I cannot thank the president enough for his personal concern and compassion for our state and for the people of our state. Of course, conservatives don't want to give the president any credit, so they took to the airwaves and internet to bash Chris Christie. Rush Limbaugh called Christie a fat and a fool. The Drudge Report attacked his friendliness toward Obama, and a Daily Caller reporter called Christie, quote, a prop for Obama's reelection, end quote. I guess in conservative land, it's impossible for a Republican governor to care about his state first and politics second. And the very, very ugly Bishop Daniel Jenke. Jenke, the same Illinois Catholic bishop who compared President Obama to Hitler last April, is back. This time he's urged, or basically directed, all of the priests in his diocese to read a letter during their weekend masses. The letter attacks Catholics who are pro-choice and basically orders Catholics, to vote for Mitt Romney. A portion of the letter reads, for those who hope for salvation, no political loyalty can ever take precedence over loyalty to the Lord Jesus Christ and to his gospel of life, end quote. The letter goes on to say that Catholic politicians and their supporters who are in favor of pro-choice policies are guilty of a grave sin. Jenke is actively trying to destroy the boundaries between church and state, and that is very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Oh, my goodness. Rick in Medford, Oregon. Hey, Rick, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mike. Well, Tom. Sorry, Tom.
It's quite all right.
It came to my attention the other day that the Detroit News in Detroit, of which I'm a native, has endorsed Mitt Romney for president.
Well, the Detroit News was always the business paper. It was always the conservative paper. The Detroit Free Press was always the Democratic paper and the labor paper, if my recollection is correct.
Yeah, well, it hurts my soul being from Detroit. My brother still lives there, and he tells me that at rush hour, there is no rush hour anymore.
No, there is no Detroit News anymore either. To the best of my knowledge, it's got to be just a little shrinking thing of a paper. The Detroit Free Press basically, bought all their competitors. It's now published by Gannett, I believe. I'm pretty sure. My brother's a printer for Gannett in Michigan, and they pump that thing out along with the USA Today. But so the Detroit News endorsing Romney. As far as I know, the Detroit News is just a website now. This is nothing to be taken seriously. when you have Mayor Bloomberg, unless you're a Republican shill caller who just got paid to go on the air on a station and say, hey, did you know the Detroit News endorsed Romney? Right. The Economist, the most widely read economic publication, the Business Week of the world, just endorsed President Obama. The Economist. Mayor Bloomberg, once a Republican, now an independent, mayor of one of the largest cities in the world, just endorsed Obama. So, you know, I see your website that has become a newspaper that has become a website that has become a blog, and raise it an actual magazine with worldwide circulation and an actual mayor of an actual city that's probably got a population about the same as the whole state of Michigan. Larry in Victoria, British Columbia. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
I know you were talking about, tolls earlier. And up here in B.C., we fought back a toll under our neoconservative government in about 2006, 2005. A lot of emails and phone calls to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And a long-term solution, the lowest carbon solution that will get more people out of their cars more quickly than even light rail transit, are resorting to free bus service in our inner cities, like the Bus Riders Union is suggesting.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that mass transit is really the very simple answer. Again, if the streets are too congested, give people an alternative, but don't destroy the transportation commons. Thank you for the point. This is one of the big debates that we have to have. One of the big discussions we have to have in the United States is, what is the commons? What is it that we all collectively own that is never going to be used for the profit of one particular group of investors or owners or you know, whatever? What is the commons? What is it that we are going to say, we all own this? It's for all of us. You've got libertarians now calling for the privatization of fire departments. They've been calling for the privatization of schools for 20, 30 years. Now they want to privatize roads. I mean, at what point do you say enough already? You know why Hugo Chavez got reelected down in Venezuela? Because he said the oil under the ground of Venezuela is the commons. It no longer belongs to BP and ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips or whatever. It's the commons now. And so the money, the profit that comes from that oil in Venezuela is going to be used for the good of all. It's going to be used to improve the schools. He has reduced poverty radically in that country, increased educational participation and outcomes. It's really simple stuff. He talks a big game, but you know he's only half a socialist. Well, he's more of a democratic socialist, but you know it's end of rant. Anne in Somerville, New Jersey. Hey, Anne, you wanted to talk about the commons?
Yeah. Hi. Tom, nice to talk to you. I've been listening to your show for a long time. I just finished reading a book called The Threshold by a guy by the name of Tom Hartman.
Yeah.
I think you probably know him.
Yes.
Interesting. But
thank
as you.
You
were talking about the common good earlier, what struck me was the fact that when we mix government and business, apparently we never learn from our mistakes. And I think that goes back to your recitation of history every 80 years, and the old saying is history repeats itself because we never learn the first time.
Right.
But you talk about Mussolini and the fascist state that was created in Italy as a result of the merger of business and the state interests.
Yes.
And in fact,
Mussolini invented the word fascism.
Exactly. Right. From the Italian word fasci, I believe it is?
Yes, which is the bundle of sticks that is tied together with a rope, showing that, you know, United States, if you take the various, at that time, Italian city-states, you know, Venice used to be its own nation and whatnot, and you tie them together, it becomes unbreakable. And the fasce, by the way, is part of the seal that's on the, you know, in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives. It's part of the seal in the United States. But it was his big thing, was the fascia, yeah.
So my question to you, I guess, is that, God forbid that Mitt Romney gets elected and we become a fascist state or a whatever you want to call it, fascist state of some sort with the mixing of business and government, which, of course, we know that Eisenhower and Teddy Roosevelt railed against, especially Eisenhower in his closing address, that,
yes,
you know, beware the in growing in military-industrial complex.
Yep.
What with all the righties, you know, who are always railing against the against government, this is the quintessential mixing of government and business.
Right.
How do you think that they would respond to that, I guess, would be my question.
Do I think that the right wing would be worried about fascism? No.
Yes.
I mean, fascism is, by definition, a right-wing ideology. I would submit, though, to you, Anne, that we're three-quarters of the way there already, that Citizens mm-hmm. United was the
right.
the ultimate fascistic statement in the classic sense, in the sense of the original meaning of the word, the merger of corporate and state interests. When you've got outside interests, largely corporate interests, many of them transnational corporate interests, you've got money coming in from China via Shelley Adelson into the Republican, you know, into ads supporting Republican candidates. We've flipped. I mean, there's more money going into these campaigns from private interests than there is public. We tried public financing after the Nixon scandals, but it's just, you know, the Supreme Court has made it so hard after the Buckley decision and then the Bilotti decision and then the Citizens United decision, it made it so hard to have any kind of public financing that even our elections are now owned by the highest bidder. So that's a real tragedy. Anne, you are, Shane tells me, you are the winner or the lucky recipient of a copy of Unequal Protection. Do you have one already?
I do not.
Oh, wonderful. Great. Unequal Protection.
It will be a nice segue from finishing your book.
There you go. Oh, well, this is also my book. I wrote this. This is Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. So, Anne, hang on to the line there. She's on line one. You tell Danielle, and Danielle will get your address information, and we'll, stamps.com will... We will send you a book brought to you by Stamps.com postage. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Mike asks in Indiana, are there any real Republicans left anymore? Good question. We'll pick up Mike's call in a little bit.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell him, Leonard, Mike in Carmel, Indiana. Are there any real Republicans left anymore, Mike?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I'll tell you this much. I'm feeling blue in a red state here.
Yeah.
Just giving you a call. But interesting thing, I think it was retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Yeah. Former assistant to Colin Powell in the Bush administration.
Right. And he was responding to Republicans, or at least, you know, some Republicans, I guess, responding to the fact that the only reason, forgive me if I'm quoting this incorrectly, the only reason Colin Powell is endorsing Obama is because he's black. And
now, it wasn't Wilkerson who said that. It was John Sununu,
the co-chair
of the Romney campaign.
Right, and he was responding to Sununu saying there are racists in my party. And
Wilkerson responded to Sununu. Yes, you're right.
Correct. Wilkerson responded to that comment.
Yeah.
A friend of mine said, you know, it's just not right that the Republicans have this label. And I said, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't so much blame the image on, you know, Republicans. It's the party that took over the Republican Party. And, you know, it almost seems like Barry Goldwater is a distant memory for Republicans these days.
Yeah, although Barry Goldwater was opposed to the Civil Rights Act, but he was not opposed to it because he was a racist. He was opposed to it because he thought it was, you know, excessive government, you know, whatever. But I think that, you know, our memories need to be refreshed from time to time. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Governor Ted Strickland is on the line with us, the former governor of the great state of Ohio, where it seems elections go to be decided. Governor, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
So Nate Silver has bet Joe Scarborough $1,000 that President Obama is going to win. And I'm guessing that he thinks that part of that path is going to go through Ohio. On the other hand, there is this machine out there. I mean, with the Romney campaign passing out booklets to their poll watchers telling them to give dishonest information to people who want to vote and to challenge voters and you know, trying to knock people off the rolls and whatnot. What's going on in your state, sir?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, Governor Romney's also involved in a real controversial position that he's taken regarding the auto industry, having claimed publicly that Chrysler was going to move jobs out of Ohio to China.
Right.
That resulted in, you know, the CEO of Chrysler putting forth a public statement contradicting what the Governor Romney had said. And then the governor doubled down on his claims and included GM, implied in his ads that GM was moving jobs out of Ohio to China. And so the CEO of GM, through his spokesman, put out a strong statement.
Yeah.
That particular issue has been dominating the political discourse, I think, in Ohio over the last 2 days. And
right.
I think it's been very harmful to Governor Romney's chances here in Ohio.
So people are figuring out that this guy has a history of being a flip-flopper. I referenced the voter suppression efforts, and I know that there have been some attempts to do that in Ohio as well, but it's happening all over the country. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, championed these laws, these photo ID, you know, multiple ID laws, whatever, and has been pushing this. The co-founder of the American Legislative Exchange Council is a guy named Paul Weyrich, who helped run the Reagan campaign and both Bush campaigns. And if I may play for you 20 seconds of Paul Weyrich, he also was the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, his thoughts on how Republicans can win campaigns in the future. He was speaking to a group of Republicans in a church. Here he is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now, that's the official Republican strategy. What do we do?
Well, if I was a Republican, I would be embarrassed to belong to a party that would agree with such a philosophy. It's elitism, and it's wrong. And I think that's why the Republican Party is in trouble these days.
Yeah.
Because I think the average citizen has figured out that these guys are not on our side.
Well, and in fact, they have to basically make stuff up to try and even have talking points. There's a case in point, Chrysler, what you were just mentioning, Governor.
Well, I think this auto situation and what Governor Romney is saying and doing here in Ohio goes well beyond the auto issue. I think it gets to an issue of character, honesty, trustworthiness. I think Governor Romney has a problem with the truth. I think the Republican Party has a fear of the voter.
Yeah.
That's why we've seen these multiple efforts to suppress the vote, to make it more difficult for people to vote. I mean, these people ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah.
This is America. Everybody, counts. Everybody should have an opportunity to participate. I think they're going to lose this election. And if they don't change their ways, they're going to have a difficult time ever winning another national election.
Yeah.
You can't turn your back on these children who were brought here by their parents without papers.
Yeah.
And
the Dream Act and all these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
You're basically paraphrasing Dwight Eisenhower's letter to his brother Edgar in 1954, where he said, you know, any party that suggests we should do away with Social Security will never be heard from again. You know, and he said, I know that there's a small number of Texas oil men who think it's possible, but their number is small and they are stupid. he was right. Governor, former governor of Ohio, Ted Strickland, sir, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Hey, it's great talking with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great talking with you, too. Get your questions ready. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, an hour of Bernie Sanders. And, of course, Anything Goes Friday. What do you want to talk about as we head into this election weekend, the last weekend before the election? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you getting out there and getting active. It's more than just voting, although that's damn important. Tag You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.